motion?
Mr. Chairman? Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you again for the technology and having a slot in, Mr. Cutton.
That's fine.
Much done, Mr. Summary.
Seems to see the flash of mine for the weekend.
Yeah. Plenty of these today.
Included in the proposed Queenstown Lake District plan in relation to the Jackson Point zone. The main findings of my evidence were community economic well-being and the efficient use of resources are relevant considerations under the RMA. In economic terms, market interventions such as land use constraints are only justified where clear external costs have been identified and the significance of these external costs is such that they outweigh the cost of the form of the intervention proposed. There are a range of economic benefits from limiting constraints on the provision of retail, commercial, education and health activities within the Jacks Point Village activity area. These include greater competition in the market for the supply of land for this range of development activities, savings in transport costs, including vehicle operating, travel time, accident and congestion cost savings, greater convenience, optimised and efficient use of the JPZ infrastructure capacity, more affordable housing, and reduce pressure for development on less suitable land within the district. Retail and commercial professional service activities provided within the village activity area are likely to generally meet the convenience shopping and other needs of Jackson Point's residents, overnight visitors and businesses. They will not usurp the role of the larger comparison shopping centres within the district, in particular Queenstown CBD and Grantham, because of A, the population base of Jackson Point. Current projections are for Jacks Point to eventually reach around 4,500 households. B, Jacks Point being separated from other population business centres within the district, and I'll advise commissioners that during the hearing someone has made reference to Greymouth that they're being a preparer to be similar size, and since it's my hometown many years ago, before I became a cottonseller as a coal miner, that district does have a 4,500 households is a population of somewhere north of 8,000 people, so Greymouth would be a similar size. And whilst Jacks Point is separate from the main shopping centres elsewhere in the district, Greymouth is 3 hours from Christchurch, the next main shopping centre, if you like. And it's that reason why Greymouth has a warehouse, has two supermarkets, and has a level of its own, if you like, comparison shopping, albeit a lot of people still go over the hill to spend their money from time to time. C, the now proposed 3,000 metre square cap on the permitted size of individual retail and commercial activities. D, other centres in the district have a wide range of retail and commercial activities and are already well established. E, these other centres will also be the places of employment for some Jacks Point residents and places of destination for other trips. So commuting to work and other trips will be combined with shopping trips at these other established centres. This will limit still further opportunity for comparison shopping of any significant scale to become established at Jacks Point. And lastly, growth in the district generally will dissipate any redistribution of trade effects for other centres. Also, it is now proposed to reduce the area of land available for commercial, retail and community activities from that in the ODP and in the notified PDP. The ODP had 28.95 hectares of commercial land and 10 towns of Jacks Point villages. The proposal now advances a reduction of that to 26.8 hectares, consolidated into one village, with a large component of that to be used for education. The specific provisions being sought by submitters for JPZ are consistent with a number of objectives and policies in the proposed plans, Chapter 3, Strategic Directions, and Chapter 4, Urban Development. They are also consistent with a number of the objectives and policies of the National Policy Statement on Urban Development Capacity 2016. The relief sought by the submitters is consistent with enabling people and communities to provide for their economic well-being and having regard to the efficient use and development of natural and physical resources. Responses to council legal submissions. I note that paragraph 6.13 does the submission say that Mr. Heap supports a cap for commercial activities within the village activity area, which is less than the 9.9 hectares. In fact, Mr. Heap does not specify a particular cap, although he has done some forecasts of the area of retail and commercial activities which might be required at Jack's Point. I believe Mr. Heap's analysis may be useful for illustrative purposes, but it is necessarily speculative at this time. At paragraph 6.15, the submission argues that a limit on retail and commercial activities is necessary to prevent such activities being developed to a scale and scope that might create tension with BDP's strategic directions and objectives. My evidence has provided reasons as to why I consider this tension will not occur without a cap. Mr. Heap's summary of evidence. Mr. Heap, in his summary of evidence, argues that a cap is required on retail and commercial activities within the village activity area, again because it will prevent such activities being developed to scale and scope that might create tension with the BDP strategic directions and objectives. In my view, because of the factors which I have listed in my evidence and which will prevent retail and commercial activities developing at Jack's Point that will undermine other commercial centres within the district, e.g. the Queenstown CBD or Franklin, a flexible approach to retail and commercial development can be maintained. To place a limit on such activities, which have no economic, environmental or social costs, is unnecessarily restrictive and prevents a flexible response to future market requirements being adopted. This is to Heath's apparent concerns about land being set aside for retail and commercial uses not being available for other uses, e.g. high-density residential development, medical facilities, community facilities and educational activities, can be overcome and is more efficiently addressed by letting the market determine the final mix of land uses within the village without prescriptive land area caps or limits for particular types of activities. Mr. Heap, in his evidence in chief, has concerns about commercial development within the Jack's Point village being dispersed and therefore undermining the commercial centre of the village itself. I agree, but this is not overcome by a cap, but by instead appropriate planning for both the village and surrounding area to avoid dispersal of activities such as visitor accommodation that is more suited to the village. I understand that Mr. Ferguson has recommended a discretionary status for visitor accommodation in the residential areas to address this concern. At paragraph 11 of the summary, Mr. Heap suggests, I assume, that all of the activities proposed for Jack's Point Village will eventuate, whereas he considers there remains considerable uncertainty if the envisaged land uses within the village will be developed to a scale required to fill 26.8 hectares. In fact, my evidence does not assume this. I understand that allowances to be made for areas of open space and provision of 2 hectares for education purposes. In addition, nobody is capable of forecasting the other forms of future development at Jack's Point or elsewhere with absolute certainty. However, it is necessary to make certain provisions in the plan to enable different types of development envisaged within the JPC. Mr. Heath himself has made certain assumptions about the future level of residential and visitor accommodation development within Jack's Point to make estimates for the possible land requirement for retail and commercial services within the village at full capacity. The differences between Mr. Heap and I are that I do not think it is necessary to be prescriptive about the maximum area for retail and commercial development, given the factors at play with Jack's Point Village Activity Area. Mr. Heap thinks there may be potential costs in terms of significant trade competition effects, undermining the CBD and Franklin existing centres. I'll just emphasise the word significant. Those of you who have been involved in these retails, so I've exercised under the RMA before, be aware of the history about the requirement to find significant trade competition effects before I can then go on to ask the question, which is relevant under the RMA, as to whether in fact it undermines the amenity values and so forth of those centres. But the first step requires significant impacts, not just some level of trade competition. And secondly, whereas I consider the risks of such significant trade competition effects are negligible. Also, I think there are economic benefits from enabling developers at Jack's Point to be nimble and responsive to market demand now and in the future. This is consistent with, rather than creating tension with, the plan's objectives and policies, the FPS on urban development capacity, economic efficiency, and economic well-being.
So, can I just clarify that my Ms. Copeland's expert opinion is that there are no pets justified, but that is different from my client's offer to accept them if they are imposed if a reason is found, but there was no need for Ms. Copeland to change his opinion.
I understand the distinction between the expert's opinion and the client's position.
And then I just wanted to correct one thing you didn't spot on page 2 of the summary, subparagraph C. The proposed 300 square metre cap is only being proposed by the Jack's Point in respect of retail, individual retail, not to be proposed in respect of commercial activities.
The other thing, while we're looking at some paragraph C, is that hopefully, when you read it out, you see 3,000 square metres. Would you like to correct that?
There's an order of magnitude. We economists may get this from time to time.
Yes,
an order of magnitude tense probably. Sorry.
Okay, I just want to clarify it.
Yeah, and then there's one other point of clarification that paragraph 14, where Mr. Heath refers to Mr. Ferguson's recommendation in respect of visitor accommodation being restricted discretionary, that specifically respected the hand downs residential areas because it's already fully discretionary in the residential checkpoint areas.
Right.
Thank you.
Which one
from the discussion we've been having over the last few days, my understanding is that the cap on individual retail is at, well, for the debate over whether it's 200 or 300 square metres, but I presume you're aware that we're basically stomping on that because even if we wanted to change that threshold, we can't. There's no scope to do so.
I think that's a legal question. That's a coping in the dress guard's merits, but I don't think you need to question this.
I don't come to that.
Until 2 days ago, I was working for 200 square metres and understand. The suggestion that we move 300 on the basis that this would enable provision for a larger, just a corner area, but a larger four square store or supermarket or whatever, and that seems sensible to me. But as to whether you're able or not, it's like obviously it's a legal advantage.
Yeah, because I think I raised this a couple of days ago, because on the face of it, 200 seems extremely small. On your comment that your view is it's unlikely that sort of these larger scale developments would occur in this area because of their proximity to remarkable park and Queenstown. But I am aware that there are, more than 300, but reasonably sized supermarkets in places like Kaikoura, for example. Now, while that's passing traffic, Kaikoura has a population of about 3,000 people, so you need to support a supermarket. I know that it's a very competitive industry, so there would surely be some demand for bigger shopping facilities than you have suggested.
Two things on it. Mr. Heath and his evidence usually provides a rough guide of 5,000 households justifies a supermarket. That's not a hard and fast thing. And that's why I think he said there should be person made here for a supermarket for full capacity. In terms of the Kaikoura, again, it's a bit linked back to my discussion about Greenland, and that is that it's whilst Jack's Point is somewhat isolated from the Marcus Park in Queenstown, it's certainly not as isolated as Kaikoura is in Christchurch or Lennon, and therefore, one can see where, for example, county owns a fresh choice option, which is probably, and they may have an actual square metre guideline off the top of their head, it might be in the vicinity of 1,500. To 2,000 square metres, where a fully fledged supermarket is just right now. Equal number, we'd be talking about 3.5 to 4, so without being a 5,000 factor saying, I wouldn't see a factor saying, so we've got the argument there that a new world or a moderate countdown. But that full capacity, so between now and full capacity, one can see an immediate step of a supermarket or whatever. And I understand that for that, even if it's not explicitly provided for, someone can come in and seek the source and seek the good work to do.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Just one on your summary levels, page 2, 6, subpoint F. I wonder if you could explain that in closing the district generally will dissipate any redistribution of
the effects of the test. Could you expand on what you mean?
Well, in an area which is growing, we're concerned about significant trade competition effects on Franklin and Queen's CBD. Supposing even if development at Jack's Point was able to siphon off 5% of trade in Franklin across rivers, ports, supermarkets, and so forth. With the growth of plus 1.5% in 3 years' time, 4 years' time, that effect would have gone. First of all, I think it's completely unlikely that the would side of those types of activities, let alone that level of trade across the whole area. But what I'm saying is that as an extra safeguard, when you've got a reasonable amount of growth, then the census would at least stand still. But in my view, that will still continue to grow because of growth resistance.
I think we could have the opportunity to go through in detail all your appendix one. But are there any example retail centre projects that you've worked on which might have involved a suburban area close to a large centre? I don't know, examples of front line that could be similar in context to Jack's Point versus Queenstown might be Chipotle and Tauranga or North and Hastings.
Yes. I currently live around there, just 45 minutes north of Wellington.
Yeah.
And we have on the two beach areas, and it's not Jack's Point, it's not Queenstown. But I think it's very nice. Exactly, does have a beach, but we have the captain is an area of 40,000 people.
I'm reasonably familiar with it.
Yeah. So we've got Coastlands and the Parafran Town Centre, and there's all sorts of debate about that. We have one of the big debates going on, and the reason why I missed the plane on Wednesday was because of the hearing where the airport company wishes to have development on this land and Coastlands. Trying to protect this batch, let's say, but not being trade feathers or rules. But there's a relevance to me, two beach communities, Parabran Beach and Ramadan Beach, and I live in between the two of them.
Right.
So I'm very familiar. It's fantastic because I'm a bit hot and drinking and driving, but I do like the drinks and I can walk or bike, unsold cafes, whatever. But to me, we've got those two isolated communities from the town centre. And the way they have built up this system, I got before this hearing reason, I got my daughter, who's the second best retail consultant in New Zealand, her mother is the best, to go around and identify, or retail practitioner perhaps, but to identify the outlets in each of the centres. And, I can't predict the future, and Jack's Point is skiing and golf, and we do have a bit of a golf course not too far away, but it's not as iconic as Jack's Point. We've got something like 28 cafes, takeaways, restaurants, bars in Parabran Beach, about 14 in Raleigh Beach. We have got six beauty salons / spa laser away here on the look for the top places. But we also have probably in Parafran Beach 4 women's clothing shops, in Ramadi Beach maybe 3 women's clothing fantastic things, tiny little holy smoke bean shop sells great shoes, but so you get a little bit of what they call fine grain comparison retail.
That's right,
it adds to it. In this particular instance we have I'm part of it now because I've got my golf card, but we have an older average population and the cap there, sort of the dogs holding them or whatever they say. The women's shops, I'm told, because I must ring to try and get, but they're not the Katie's, the Glassons, Country Road. They are aimed at the more mature and they don't even say, but plus sizes sort of thing. So, and it would be because of local fences and that people, you know, who walked it. Now, I'm not saying Jack's Point is going to be grab-and-fix or whatever, but the each place is different, and you get a little bit of that, but there's no one in the world that those beach centres in any way undermine the coastal centre. We certainly don't have farms, we don't have Kmart, or you know, we don't have all the anchors, if you like, department stores and so forth, and the 300 metre cap is going to prevent those sort of anchors from going unless they go to resources.
I think that the comparison shots that you were talking about would easily fit within a 300 square metre cap.
Yes, they would. They would. The only, and it's been raised, the one that from my thinking is a very one in large, it's not a fresh choice, but we do have an enlarged dairy.
So that's a convenient shop, we must have one.
But it's purely convenient. No one's going to bypass Platinum Save or New World or Countdown to go all the way to wherever. But they will actually bypass it for Saturday morning market days because the eggs are yellow apparently.
Do you think, using that example and the similarity perhaps to Jack's Point, that the relative isolation from the main thoroughfare, which is State Highway 1 and Kevin Coast, whereas the new expressway constructed eventually?
I'm saying it's opening.
Is it?
Yes, today was the cutting the ribbon. Saturday, so I can take over one next week. She's all going.
Well, good. I'm driving down there, I guess, so I can try it.
$630 million.
Really, though, the question is the separation of those beach, the Ramadian Caribbean beach, from the main through route, which is similar. Is that similar to what we would end up with the village down in Jack's Point relative to the state highway?
Yes, it is, although I would argue that the through route, and that is just like Jack's Point, it's not a shopping destination in itself, even coastlands. It still serves the local district area.
Yeah.
Right? So, but it's probably similar time. I've just checked before about the travel times. It's so difficult to say what is the travel time between Jack's Point and Franklin and Queenstown now, depending on traffic problems. But 10 minutes maybe if you didn't have a question. And I would say it's 10 minutes between those two centres and Coastlands now. And that's enough separation, if you like, to say, well, I'm not going down there to get a loaf of bread or the newspaper or the milk because I'm short. But when I'm going to do the supermarket shop, I am going to go 10 minutes away to the supermarket. When I go and buy jeans, dresses, whatever, a new fridge or whatever, I will go that far away. I don't need fridge shops in my local settlements. So the Harvey Normans and what have you, Smith City, they're not going to go in those two settlements. And similarly, the fine grain comparison retail, but you might get a bit of it. But it's not the level that would undermine Coastlands. And then again, Coastlands is not what it's now. And Coastlands doesn't have the tourist population going through it.
The hearing that you were attending, that you were attending as an expert or as a local?
No, I was attending as an expert. With a little local knowledge for a change, maybe. In that case, I was referring to Coastlands. But it's all on the public record. I do have to be careful what I say one place and another. There I'm really defending them, keep the strength, centre strong. But that was against a similar type of centre developing. I wasn't saying try and kill the two big settlements because poor old Coastlands is distracting. I mean, it's not what we're talking about. Well, I'm actually concerned there that the airport may not have an impact on the two vigilants. Now, a lot of my evidence is similar to this thing. I agree with the idea that there are only 9 minutes of building up centres and protecting centres. But I'm just thinking that there's a particular case here where I think he's going overboard to say that there's going to be significant effects on those two centres from having retail development and tax board.
Just as a bit of a follow-up, Mr. Heath estimated that the retail requirements of Jack's Point, despite what he did say, would be accommodated, including parking, said by about 2 hectares of land. In fact, we've got at least 18 hectares there. The question I asked him, does that enable the market to work? And his answer was yes. Would that also be your answer?
Well, did you put a cap on?
No, just we've got 18 hectares which can be used for retail purposes in the village centre, and he says the demand ultimately will be for about 2 hectares, including parking. Now, given what appears to be an almost embarrassing oversupply of land, would you agree that that should be more than sufficient to enable the market to work?
The 18 hectares, I certainly think the 18 hectares would be sufficient for the market to work, but the areas I understand totally, maybe you can come back with it. There was a presumption there's going to be residential development. There's a combination. There's 2 hectares set aside for education. At least, there might be more, depending on what happens with tertiary institutions and so forth. There's hope for film studio development, I understand, but it's not guaranteed. So there's a whole lot of things that are going to go on. And, Mr. Heath forgets 2.1 hectare requirement. Still have to assume some is going to be used for residential and some for visitor accommodation, at least. So, I don't believe anyone suggesting 18 hectares of commercial and retail development. And I'm just simply saying, why put a cap on if there's no harmful effects? And I agree with that, as I said, that I do accept that we don't want to disperse all around Jack's Point. We want to, in fact, some way, locate to an open force. That to me is a planning exercise. The cap doesn't come into where it is.
Thank you.
Thank you again for coming.
Classic example of what RCL are proposing to do close to Jack's Point Rise, which is an example of that, and there are others that are better suited to talk to that. My concern relates to three things. One, the reduction of the amount of reserve land, the rezoning request for FP1 and 2, and the increase in building height for the village buildings close to Lake Tipperary. And I strongly object to all of those changes. The proposed changes, I think, are completely contrary to the environment we expected to continue to live in when we bought our land and built there. So let me talk to the preserve to build ratio first. The COVID development controls, along with the original deed, which rise, I think, the 95.5% clause 1.1 of the CPC states at least 95% of the area will be retained as open space, golf course, etc. It says at least, it does not say anything less, and it's very early on in those design controls. The similar clause says the controls are there to ensure certainty in respect of the development and the design outcomes. Certainty, in my mind, is a powerful word. Certainty is an assured fact, and certainty goes beyond 14 years. It doesn't expire in that short time period. The website advertising Jack's Point to visitors and potential residents is littered with the 95.5% principle. I've attached a few examples there. It's part of its advertising, it's part of its promotion for the development. It's the reason why people buy in there. To me, a change to that is misleading. We bought into that development along with other residents, believing that would be set in stone. And I think any changes to that principle impacts that. So I actually tried to find a definition for preserve. There's nothing in the original deed, there's nothing in CDC, there's nothing in the Jack's Point Resident Owners Association Constitution, there's nothing in the OPD, there's nothing in the RMA defining preserve. So I relied on the Oxford Dictionary. And it says maintain something in its original state. In my mind, the original state of Jack's Point was the land as it was acquired for development. And yes, it's predominantly farmland, but there's a fair degree of native bush. So any changes markedly from that, i.e. chopping it up for additional housing, should be looked at as an adverse development. I actually asked the council and the committee to potentially do an accurate calculation of the 95.5. I've seen a number of calculations. Some of them have no allowance for footpaths, no allowance for roading. I don't see how that's preserved. No one can have a patio on a road. Some assume 45% site coverage, and if you look at the balance going on, I'm pretty sure there's more site coverage than that. My view, one piece of land, once it goes into private ownership, it is no longer preserved. My neighbour would take a dim view of me having a picnic on his front lawn. It is not accessible to the public, so private ownership land is no longer preserved. Mr. Darby's evidence for JPG under submitters 762856, etc., is proposing a major deviation from the 95.5 principle. In clause 24, he states JPG controls 563 hectares of land, of which approximately 500 hectares will be managed in perpetuity as either golf course or protected natural space. This actually equates to an 89:11 ratio. 95 is already slipping to 89, and if you add that back to the build area, that represents a 220% increase in the build on area in the JPG control space, and I haven't looked at the other spaces. Let me remind him, his original vision, which he stood by, was 95.5. So to me, any changes with the original intent vision are inconsistent with the expectation of current residents. They should not be tampered with. So based on that, that is why I object to the rezoning of 51 MP2 to OSG and OPSL. If it's approved, that will aid the degradation. It will significantly alter the outlook of many Jack's Point residents, myself included, it will significantly change the nature of what is essentially a rural outlook. It will significantly reduce the preserved content of Jacksonville. I and many others bought in, believing that part of the zone would not be built on. The increase in building height around Lake Tiwa is a little simpler. I refer Vicky Jones 42A report to recommending an increase in building height to 10 metres. I oppose that. The building around there is already going to block the view for most Jacks Point residents who overlook that basin. Another increasing the height to 10 metres will further degrade that. I just want to take a few minutes to address some constitutional issues that impact the governance of development at Jacks Point. And I appreciate this council and committee is not here to rule on constitutional issues. But understanding how it operates, I think, may aid your understanding. It is hard for residents to be heard and taken seriously. Jacks Point Residents Owners Association purports to represent residents. But that is not always the case, because there is a conflict of interest between the chair of that committee and who has appointed it, namely the controlling member. The controlling member is the developer. Clause 4.4a of the Constitution, a controlling member is appointed until the development of Jacks Point is fully completed as determined by the area controlling member at its sole discretion. So until that discretion is removed by no further development, the true residents and owners of Jacks Point do not have a representative voice. In essence, the area controlling member is the developer in his sole discretion. In the AGM of 2015, he used those powers to force some changes to the Constitution in spite of significant opposition from the court. So whoever tells you that that listened to us, the 40-day hearing period, is not accurate. I read Mr. Coburn's explanation in his February 15 explanation. Submission 4B displays the conflict of interest. If you go back to this February 13th submission to this committee, this conflict of interest, I think, is apparent there. So the only way for true representation of residents and owners, excluding the development, if you heard, is to reach a point where development of Jacks Point is fully complete. That is why granting changes to the zoning of land to allow the developer to continue to create sections that develop Jacks Point will only extend that control, likely until the next district plan review or until the next zoning change proposal is submitted. Allowing SP 1 and 2 zoning change allows the developer to continue to gobble up preserved land for his own interest. Now I ask the question, where will the preserve removal stop? So I ask this committee and the chair to seriously consider not allowing SP1 and 2 to go forward and seriously look at any zoning changes that allow for continual expansion and removal of the 95% principle. Thank you.
No, I think it's all pretty clear.
Okay, that's good.
Except for a passing comment, really, I suppose. Sort of illustrated to us that there are some issues with the JPR arrangement, which is now feeding through to the district plan here. There seem to be issues with the JPROA arrangements, which
correct,
are now feeding through to the planning.
Feeding through the plan, and it's impacting what the planning committee is hearing, because it's actually clause in the Constitution that says that residents cannot oppose development. So it's a little risky to come and oppose development. I think the number of residents at Jacks Point is pretty strongly enough about it without trying to be really interested in this.
Thank you.
All right, thank you for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Just clarify something. When you ask for additional time, and I said you needed some lodge for the notice in advance, the notice of hearing you said was supposed to be lodged 2 weeks ago.
I may have misunderstood that. I'm not providing expert evidence for legal submissions, and frankly, 10 minutes was just going to be slightly tight. Yeah. So but I didn't receive an email saying provide it in advance, and I did provide it 2 days ago, so I'm there.
I just clarified that just in case you're in another seat.
Hopefully not. You might not. Thank you. My wife and I have been visiting Queenstown for many years and decided to purchase property for the development of a family vacation and retirement home. After an extensive search, we purchased Lot 35 and reserved in 2012. The purchase of this property in fact required OIO approval due to the scale of landscape protection area on the lot. We made significant charitable donations for repair of Jack's Point Trails and to the Queenstown Library in connection with that OIO approval. There were very specific reasons for our choice of this particular property. The location is remote, with only a couple of residential home sites in the immediate vicinity. Not only is it far from other preserved home sites, it is also far from the golf course and any public trails. It is perhaps the most remote and secluded lot at Jack's Point. It is surrounded by landscape protection areas. And the preserve was a completed development with extremely restrictive building conditions and restrictions on further subdivision and developments applying to the lots. There would therefore be no risk of surprises from unwanted developments in the future. We have already invested considerable time and money in planning for our home, and we received a resource consent for construction last year. However, we have put our plans on hold given the uncertainty of these proposed incremental developments that would, in our view, irreparably damage the landscape and amenity values which were fundamental to our purchase of the property. We relied extensively on the written record regarding the history of Jack's Point and took great comfort from the protection afforded by the approved zoning. During the process for variation 16, a larger degree of developments on the tablelands was considered and rejected. What is currently proposed, 22 additional home sites, is in excess of the amount that was specifically rejected under variation 16. The intention of the QLDC was crystal clear, as can be seen from the following excerpts from the hearing report and decision. I'll skip the beginning of this and just read from the end. The Peninsula Hill escarpment is steep and unsuitable for development. Furthermore, the escarpment is of geological and landscape amenity value and is appropriate to preserve for future generations to enjoy. The submitter has appropriately proposed that this area be identified as the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Area and that the relevant landscape protection provisions of the Jack's Point Zone apply to that area. It is the intention of the panel that any future development on the tablelands will be avoided. This intention is reflected in covenants on the titles of lots 34 and 36, amongst others. There shall be no further subdivision, with the exception of subdivision for the purposes of boundary adjustment, which does not result in the creation of any additional allotments. I don't think this could be any more clear. Lots 34 and 36 are part of the completed preserve in their entirety, covenanted against further development. What has been proposed is a fundamental breach of the agreement reached for the development of sensitive areas of Jack's Point. Consequences of this additional development would be irreparable and unjustified damage to the landscape and amenity value of this spectacular area. In his evidence, Mr. Garvey states that the Henley Downs portion of Jack's Point was not sufficiently assessed during the variation 16 process. He suggests that we should disregard those findings in favor of the updated Cohenberg study and its more refined analysis. I disagree with this assertion. There was a multi-year process that resulted in the approval of variation 16. The decision states the submitter, in response to the Jack's Point variation, has now undertaken detailed site analysis of the Henley Downs property, similar to that which forms the basis of the analysis undertaken in support of the Jack's Point development. The Jack's Point submissions make reference to the need to respond to the changing needs of the community and completing the development. The community may have a need for more affordable housing to be catered for in the residential areas, but with respect to the open space, table land, and Peninsula Hill, the needs of the community are the same, protecting this spectacular landscape. Mr. Garvey states the 22 additional home sites are, quote, the last phase of the preserve home site program and are, quote, a key component for completion of the Jack's Point master plan. I strongly disagree with the characterization of this additional development as having been part of the original plan. The master plan has never included further development of the tablelands and Peninsula Hill. I've attached two examples of that I was able to find. Lots 34 and 36 in particular are already part of the completed preserve and restricted from further development. The process for consideration of these changes has been unduly burdensome on affected parties. PC 44 was notified in March 2013 and was finally concluded with a recommendation from the hearing commissioners and approval from QLDC in February 2016. The proposal also changed numerous times during that period, necessitating substantial time and cost to evaluate. The conclusion reached by the hearing commissioners was very clear. Again, let me just read parts of this. In all the circumstances, and again noting the planning history of this land, including the conclusions reached in the Council's decision on Variation 16, the Commission considers that the status quo should be maintained with respect to the planning status of the area proposed to be activity area at B1 table. The Commission finds that Peninsula Hill, in its entirety, is a spectacular landform that dominates views looking west along State Highway 6 and north from within the Hanley Downs and Grass Point areas. This includes its natural fold on the southern flank and its other glacial scarps. The Commission is very concerned that the proposal to bisect the feature with the development area, which will, in the Commission's view, open the door for further development to be promoted. The proposed division of Peninsula Hill to demarcate its internal fold as being able to accommodate development without having any effect on the outstanding natural landscape qualities of Peninsula Hill on either side of that fold is artificial. Skipping down to 3.3. Mr. Ferguson's evidence suggests that we should disregard these findings because of concerns regarding scope in the PC 44 process. Quote, the decision expressed some concern with the jurisdiction of council to make these changes within the scope of the submissions. The commissioner preferred the process available through the district plan review as being the most appropriate to consider these changes. I believe this is inaccurate. The commission was only concerned with scope in relation to the EIC. The commissioners did not in any way defer consideration on the matter of additional developments on the tablelands of Peninsula Hill. Their views were well considered and unequivocal. As part of their overall assessment of PC 44, the decision by the commissioners in fact imposed additional restrictions on developments in the Hanley Downs area by, for example, making all buildings non-compliant within the Peninsula Hill Landscape Protection Areas, the Lakeshore Landscape Protection Area, and the tablelands. It is indeed unfortunate that Chapter 41 of the PDP was notified prior to the conclusions of PC 44 based on private proposals that were subsequently rejected in the PC 44 process. So we are now forced to spend more time and money rehashing the same fundamental issues. Absolutely nothing presented during this process has changed the facts to be considered regarding developments on the tablelands at Peninsula Hill. It is hard for me to see how this hearing panel of the QLDC could reasonably come to a different conclusion. Specifically with regards to the merits of the proposed addition of 22 home sites represents more than the excessive development that was rejected by QLDC in the original zoning of Jack's Point. Mr. Ferguson's evidence describes this additional development as some limited opportunities for residential and visitor accommodation. I believe this is an inaccurate description. The proposal is actually a 60% increase to the currently approved developments in this area, even higher depending upon your assumptions about home sites 57 and 58, which are considerably larger. The proposal to allow home sites to cater for visitor accommodation is especially objectionable and completely out of keeping with the existing preserve development. Home sites in the preserve are restricted to residential activity only. In fact, the JVROA has stated in the past that was the intention for all visitor accommodation Jack's Point to be located in the village and lodge areas and not the residential areas, including the preserve. The proposed home sites 37, 38, 39, and 57 are located on the existing preserve lots 34 and 36, which are subject to the QLDC covenant disallowing further subdivision. These lots are already part of the completed preserve. There's nothing unique about lots 34 and 36 that suggests they were entitled to be developed differently than the rest of the preserved lots. If I can just point, I think this is an important point. I think you've only been provided with information that shows you the ownership of the lots, and you've separately been provided with different versions of where this new development will occur. You haven't seen an overlay of that, so in fact you have to work it out. But several of these lots that I've noted are actually on existing lots that are titled and part of the original preserved development. Home site 57 is particularly objectionable. It would appear to accommodate a significant size hotel. I would like to point out that I think the photographic evidence provided is quite misleading regarding the site. The photo was taken at a significant distance from the proposed home site. I estimate that the western lakeside edge of the proposed home site is nearly 500 meters from that location and much more prominent. In any case, for clarity, our position is that development anywhere on Peninsula Hill is highly inappropriate.
The question remains, why is any of this better outcome than the existing zoning, which is highly perceptive of the landscape? The so-called merits presented are extremely weak when assessed against the substantial concerns. The operative zoning has different types of open space. G and OV are for outdoor recreation and open space. The OS zoning is for pastoral and arable farming and endemic revegetation only, not even recreation or golf. This covers the whole of the Tablelands, Peninsula Hill, and the Lakeshore Landscape Protection Area. It is indeed the core of the 95% protected open space that Jack's Point committed to and was viewed as completely suitable for the sustainable management of the land. It was not a temporary solution waiting for further development. The development of 22 additional home sites in this open space is presented as an improvement in the management of the land, in part because it purports to assure a certainty of outcome and no further development. Yet this proposal is itself violating that same prior assurance that there would be no further development on the Tablelands, in particular in respect of the existing preserve, inclusive of lots 34 and 36. In summary, the proposal for an additional 22 home sites represents a fundamental breach of the agreement reached for the development of Jack's Point and disregards the clear intentions for the area. The Jack's Point and Henley Downs landowners agreed to the zoning which formed the basis for the development of the Jack's Point zone in its entirety. These proposed changes are not minor in that they seek additional 60% plus development in the Tablelands and Peninsula Hill, where further development is clearly not intended, will degrade through cumulative effects the areas that were to be maintained as open space for pastoral and arable farming only, seek to develop visitor accommodation where none was anticipated, seek to develop Peninsula Hill, which was in its entirety rigorously protected from inappropriate development. With regard to the trail, I'm very supportive of public access and public trails. I'm an avid user of the trails and even donated money for the improvements of these accessible trails. However, we purchased a lot in a completed development with an existing extensive trail network clearly identified. The current proposal seeks to relocate what was originally planned as Straggles Loop, running across Peninsula Hill and connecting to the Lakeside Trail, to a location immediately alongside the border of our lot that is attached to the exhibit of my original submission. This trail could be anticipated to have significant usage when Jack's Point reaches a population of 10,000. It's unreasonable and unnecessary to be changing this now. The original trail location should be maintained and completed as promised. Finally, we request that commissioners ensure that the intentions of Chapter 41 are not in any way undermined by other chapters of the DEP, such as Chapter 47 and subsequent. Thank you.
We have a plan provided by Jack's Point, which shows all of the home sites identified and numbered. Is yours home site 35 on the new plan? Is that correct? You might like to come and check.
I mean, all the existing home sites, I believe.
Okay.
Here's a more detailed version of the map of the.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And then what you can't see from here is that this home site 36 is part of a lot 36, which is here.
Uh-huh.
And then this home site 34 is property here.
Right.
So what you can't see is that these lots, in fact, here are all essentially being created on what would have to be subdivided out of an existing preserve home.
Yes, I suppose the difficulty we've been faced with this hearing is that there's been obviously you'll be aware of landscape evidence supporting the proponents proposed to create these 22 lots, and you'll be aware that Dr. Reed, who's employed by the council consultant, who's been by the council, has assessed those and has come to the conclusion that, subject to the removal of a few of those, relocation I should say, and that they would be acceptable in amenity, environmental amenity terms, but excluding house sites 57 and 58 within the at the bottom peninsula hill. So that's the issue we're faced with here, is that the landscape evidence we have in front of us, with the exception of those sites identified in peninsula hill, are considered by her to be what use the word acceptable was used here. As you say, it may be unfortunate with the timing of BC 44 and what's happened with this process.
I considered whether I should provide my own expert evidence in that regard. Obviously, as an individual, this has already taken up huge amounts of time and money on my behalf.
Well,
yeah, so I know it could continue for a very long time. So, also at earlier stages, I think Dr. Reed's view was for something less, was for 13 home sites, all down by the wetlands area, really much further away from the rest of the preserve. So, earlier versions of that might have been, more in the range of the acceptable spectrum. So just not anticipating, not knowing where all that would come out, is sort of difficult to decide whether we should provide additional expert evidence.
In terms of the rather open-ended JPROAD, was it your understanding, did you have an understanding or assurances that there would be no further development on the table in terms of what was told to you by the developer?
Yeah, absolutely. As my view is, if you look at the whole history of the area, I think it's very clear that there was never anticipated to be additional development in that area, and certainly not on what are already titled lots in the preserve. I mean, the preserve was a completed development by the developer many years ago. All those lots were available for sale starting from 2007, 2008. So, and it was all very clear in the history of that. There were covenants on no further development. There were single lots, very restrictive building conditions. So, even separate from how you look at the broader open space and what's appropriate for that, particularly when it comes to these lots 34 and 136 that are immediately adjacent to me, it seems to be abundantly clear that there was never any possibility of those being subdivided and further developed.
Thank you. That's all quite clear now. I found there was a plan which clarifies the very point you're making about that. Thank you.
Where I've been employed for the last 15 years under my maiden name, Joanna Day. I'm not preparing today as an expert witness, but as an affected party. In summary, I strongly object to the proposal by RCL to rezone the land bordering my property to open space community recreation and the associated changes to policies and rules on this land. I also wish to ensure the integrity of the Jacks Point zone remains uncompromised by the proposed changes to the district plan. I note that the revised proposal from RCL reduces the scale of their application, and I will address that later. But for the record, I will briefly address their original application below, but I consider it still relevant. For reference, I have added the approximate location of my property on the RCL assessment above, and I note that photograph D, Appendix 3 of Mr. SB7 shows the outlook from Jacks Point Drive above our property. In my further submission on this proposal, I stated that this submission proposes enabling development of commercial recreation buildings of a height, mass and footprint of completely inappropriate scale and site coverage within an area of existing designated open space. This is contrary to any master plan ever conceived for the area, to the findings and recommendations of the Combone Resource Study, and the existing and proposed provisions of the QLDC District Plan. It is also contrary to the original Jacks Point vision. The negative impact of this proposal would be significant on the immediate neighbours, the Jacks Point residents, the general public who use tracks and QLDC reserves adjacent to the proposal and use for State Highway 6. would have a negative impact on the visual and landscape amenities of the adjacent environment. Commercial recreation facilities also include noisy outdoor activities such as go-karting. Again, this is inappropriate and inconsistent with the checkpoint zone. Both the current and proposed structure plan allows for appropriate community facilities in this area without the addition of commercial recreation as proposed by RCL. Currently in the Opposite District Plan, which I refer to as the OUP, this land is zoned open space slash golf, with potential for buildings associated with recreation to a maximum height of 4 metres. The notified proposed district plan, the PDP, continues this level of control over recreation buildings, but allows farm buildings up to 10 metres high in the new OSL zone. Recent examples of commercial recreation buildings within the district include large sports courts, swimming pools, indoor go-karting tracks, a ski slope and a trampoline facility. These indoor activities have produced large-scale warehouse character buildings with large footprints and heights and long elevations. As pointed out by Ms. Jones and Dr. Reed, 10% of the OSBR land is equal to buildings totaling 29,000 metres square gross floor area. And when combined with a height of 10 metres, it imposes a drastic change from what was previously permitted under the ODP. As a comparison example, the Queenstown and Bethlehem building, not including the swimming pool, is approximately 3,100 metres square. Dr. Reed agrees with my first submission when assessing the impact of this proposal on the neighbouring residential areas, where she considers that this proposal would have an adverse effect on the community of these residents, and that it would diminish the quality of views from these dwellings and their anticipated amenity. Ms. Jones agrees with this statement in her S42A report and concludes, with reference to expert opinions from Mr. Compton Moan and Dr. Reed, together with additional planning considerations, that this proposal is inappropriate and should be rejected. Anticipated amenity. Dr. Reed states that the quality of residents' anticipated amenity would be diminished. On this matter, my husband and I recognise the outstanding residential amenities provided by the development in Jackson Point Estate, and this was a primary consideration in our decision to establish our family home in this location. We bought into the unique Jackson Point concept presented to us as the original vision. The original Derby Park is Jackson Point master plan, which doesn't include handing out the homes that day, includes many positive elements such as the village, walking tracks, sustainable wastewater management, and golf courses, but primarily it creates neighbourhoods which are buffered and separated from each other and from different land uses by important and carefully designed open space areas. These are integral to the success of the subdivision and greatly enhance the residential amenity. Non-residential land uses are carefully located within the zone to provide benefits for the residents and wider community, creating a high standard of residential development but with minimal adverse impact. The developed outcome created thus far is considered harmonious and balanced, and will continue to be so if the zone is developed in accordance with the original vision. When we purchased our section, as part of our due diligence, we reviewed the controls on this RCL land in the ODP, and researched, among other references, the 95% maximum site coverage agreed to in the stakeholders' deed, which is listed, along with development controls and design guidelines, as a method of implementing the ODP objectives and policy. We also examined the Combourn resource study and the Jackson Point master plan. We observed that the ODP specifically lists preservation of the open space and rural amenity in section 12.5 under environmental resource results anticipated at Jackson Point. We therefore concluded that any buildings permitted on this RCL land would be 4 metres high maximum. On a small scale, the Combourn resource study suggests that any built form is clustered together with an open space and hunkered down into the surrounding topography and planting to ensure that any buildings are viewed as serving the landscape. It was reasonable for us to assume that activities permitted on the land would not drastically change. Had we known the zone would change to allow buildings of significantly greater bulk and with such adverse impact on our amenity, we would not have bought our section and invested in construction of our family home. Other considerations. In the body of her evidence, Dr. Green states that she considers the effect on the residential neighbouring community to be adverse, as discussed above. However, in her executive summary, she omits this information and concludes that the effect of this type of development would be relatively small, I assume from public places such as the State Highway. whilst I'm not here as an landscape architect today, I respectfully disagree with Dr. Reed's conclusion in the season. I do not consider that there has been sufficient expert analysis of the effect of this type of proposal in this specific location to make this conclusion, especially when considering the substantial area in which buildings could occur and the additional public places they could proceed from, such as nearby tracts and QRDC reserves. The potential effects of this scale of development needs to be properly analysed through visual assessment using profile poles or accurate 3D modelling methods in order to prove that the effects of proposed drastic change in land use would indeed be relatively small. This generalised statement is also contrary to Dr. Reed's recommendation to reject the proposed incorporation of the education activity area into the Jacks Point Village activity area due to concerns regarding inappropriate visibility from State Highway 6. However, as shown in the graphic below, this area is located directly behind the OSPR land and viewed from the State Highway. Therefore, these proposed large-scale buildings by RCL would be visible in the foreground of the education activity area, and so by the same logic, inappropriate. The revised RCL proposal is clearly of a reduced scale and therefore potentially reduced adverse impacts on the residential areas compared to the original submission. As one would expect, considering the extent and scale of the original proposal. The revised proposal includes a graphic depicting a possible scenario of a school, with both Mr. Wells and Mr. Esty using this as an example of what may be achieved. However, it is important to note that this is not a real school application, it's just a theoretical example, and no more likely to be developed in this manner than not, especially considering that an education facility is also recommended to be located in the education activity area directly across Narrow Jack Road from this site, and as a controlled activity within Hand Downs. I note that the suggested scheme shows an access road and a sports field encroaching over the QRDC-owned land, which I do not imagine would realistically occur. Plus, it ignores practical site planning requirements such as orientating buildings and outside areas for shelter from the infamous Jack's Point winds, which would ultimately require a different layout. It is at best an imaginative visual aid and should not be relied upon during this decision-making process. Richard Bramman, a resource management lawyer and Jack's Point resident, makes an excellent point in his evidence regarding the process for providing additional school facilities in the district. If the Ministry of Education identifies a need for a new school facility and an appropriate location within Jack's Point, then the Minister can utilise the designation process, and therefore the request for additional provisions for education activities is opportunistic and speculative. Indeed, to my knowledge, no one without a financial interest in establishing an education facility has looked at the zone holistically and considered the appropriateness of providing one at all. This reinforces the point above that this revised proposal is no more than an example, and that no weight can be afforded to the scenario of the land being developed in this manner. To use my own example of a potential scenario, I am aware that an original intention was to enable development of an indoor tennis facility on this land. This revised proposal from RCL specifically retains commercial recreation as an activity, albeit packaged up a little differently by adding and focusing on an educational land use. And Mr. Esty in his evidence claims that a sports training facility could be one of the educational uses permitted. If the zoning and rules relaxed in the proposed district plan to allow 7 metre high commercial recreation or educational buildings with a gross floor area of 5,000 metres squared, and that becomes the accepted baseline for the land, an indoor tennis facility is only a small stretch of these rules in height alone when the application is made to council, and where previously it would have been rejected outright under the ODP. As mentioned earlier, the Queensland Event Centre is approximately 3,100 metres squared, so we're easily back to the potential for large buildings unsuitable for this location and with significant adverse effects on amenity, which I was rejected during my first submission. In my opinion, this becomes particularly likely when a school has been established in the education activity area across Narrow Jack Road, and the argument is made that this need has been met. Notwithstanding that scenario, the revised proposal and association rules are still a significant departure from what was allowed and expected under the ODP. Mr. Wells argues that commercial recreation is an activity that was already catered for in the operative and proposed district plan, and provides a baseline of what we should accept as being permitted on land. Mr. Espy repeats this, however I disagree with these statements. The ODP allows the use of zone G/F, for recreation activities, outdoor recreation activities, and open space. And both the operative and proposed district plan and commercial recreation have an entirely separate definition. Surely if commercial recreation was intended to be the case for in the zone provisions and it had its own definition available for use in the OPP, it would have been included as a specified permitted activity, not just vaguely implied as Mr. Welch suggests. In addition, Dr. Reed states that commercial recreation would be in addition to the hybrid rule for OSAs and OSL land, and that commercial recreation is the only new activity for the area. Whilst if the SB concludes that the activities will have no more effect on the operative and proposed provisions, I consider that he is making this assessment based on his imaginary school example, which does not accurately reflect the complete scope of possibilities for development that would be enabled by the changes requested by RPL. And that in addition to allowing substantially larger buildings with lots of open space, commercial recreation wording was never included in the operative and proposed provisions, and therefore the statement is incorrect. RCL agrees the state policies are handed down quite considerably, to the point where it no longer applies to the land they are developing. I see nothing that would suggest that RCL would honour the state policies as it applies to this land either, and therefore conclude that they would be prepared to push the boundaries through the resource consent or plan change process to enable a proposal that is inappropriate but profitable on this land. RCL have developers' rights on this land as it applies to a residence non-objection covenants, which were put in place at the outset to allow the original vision of the Jack's Point zone to be fulfilled. We as residents are reliant on a robust district plan to preserve the integrity of the zone and ensure these initial promises to fulfill this vision made via such agreements and supported through the operative district plan, which we accepted when we purchased our properties on the understanding that would be upheld and carried through to completion. This becomes vital when ownership changes to a party not committed to the original vision. Much as our residential covenants are there to protect and allow development of the original vision, RCL's responsibilities and commitments to this outcome are the same by these agreements tied to the land. And like us, they would have been aware of this when they purchased it. Mr. Whiteman has stated that RCL is not a land banker, it is an active residential developer. Therefore, I consider that this land will remain under federal development beyond that enabled in the OEP whilst it is under RCL ownership. I know that myself and a number of Jack's Point residents requested that the village be allowed to develop to be commercially viable. John Darby, the developer and proponent of the original vision, has stated in his evidence that non-residential activities should occur away from the village. I support his view. I also agree with Link's submissions, which summarise the Jack's Point Group's position on this proposal. In conclusion, the revised RPL application does not offer any certainty of amenity to the nearby residents in comparison to the certainty that is currently provided by the Oxford District Plan. It does not offer removal of its request for commercial recreation land use, which could be omitted if indeed school was the desired outcome. Thus, RCL stated a desire to develop the land for educational and or recreational purposes. I trust in this case Mr. Whiteman means commercial recreation as he goes on to define the interest of parties as commercial and community groups. Mr. Espy did not suggest in his evidence that the imaginary scenario proposed presents the limits of what he considers appropriate for the land, nor does his example demonstrate the complete scope of development RCL are applying for, yet he bases his assessment on this. RCL have offered no restriction on the location of the building. Indeed, it is the JPROA who have highlighted that the wastewater pipe locations may restrict built form on this land, despite RCL's claim that they can relocate the sea, which in itself raises significant concerns. Dr. Trevelyan's evidence is limited to just educational land use, and nevertheless concludes that school buildings could be located in other places within the site, just with more acoustic mitigation than is utilised. The proposed OSDR zone remains large. The building or buildings could end up roughly where shown in the fictitious scenario presented by Mr. Espy as well, but they could also end up in an entirely different location depending on their use, such as directly outside residential. The revised proposal should therefore be rejected in its entirety. and I'll just briefly touch on the integrity of the checkpoint zone. I've read the general section 42A report and I agree with most of the recommendations you make since they alleviate my wider concerns that the landscape importance of the zone has been neglected within the proposed district plan that's placed in my further submission. This specifically includes the following: reinstating the wording of the zone objective to include the phrase while having appropriate regard for the landscape and amenity values, rejecting the OSPR zone, additional policy 42128 regarding visual impact. In addition, I request that Dr. Reed's recommendations retain policy 3.3 of the ODP, which states to require the external appearance, bulk and location of buildings to have regard to the landscape values of the site, is included in the proposed district plan zone objectives and policies. Preservation of the open space and rural amenity listed in section 12.15 under environmental results anticipated at the checkpoint of the ODP is incorporated within the proposed district plan. In future district plan reviews, the ordinary checkpoint residents rather than just the developer-led and controlled JCRRA are consulted in the preparation process, and references to the stakeholders need to be carried over to the proposed district plan. In my original submission, I requested that all rules as they concern buildings in the G/S zone to be continued. This was supported by the group of checkpoint landowners as defined in this general report. The proposed district plan rule 41.5.12 allows farm buildings of 10 metres height in the OSL, which I still oppose. Richard Brown will discuss this further in his evidence and legal submission, and I concur with his findings. I will also refer you to my evidence sections 3 and 4 above as it applies to 10 metres tall buildings in this area. If this rule cannot be rejected, I request that an additional rule is added that any farm buildings in OSL over 4 metres tall be located a minimum of 100 metres away from residential property boundaries, or a matter of control is added over the location and size of the building with respect to the effect on any resident outlook or amenity. This is to allow the construction of farm buildings as required to enable the land to be farmed efficiently, but to keep the impact of this on residents similar to the 4 meter building restriction provided by the ODP. This is also to ensure continued amenity certainty for residents should a farm shed be erected on the RPL land, then its use change over time. I consider this as a reasonable request considering the size of the land parcel. Other Jacks Point residents make excellent points regarding separating Jacks Point from the rest of the zone, and I refer to their evidence and statements on that, if I should say I agree with them. In general, I agree with Dr. Reed and Ms. Jones' assessment of the suitability for development of the preserved home sites, formerly FP1 and FP2, i.e. that some, but possibly not all, are suitable for approval, but that each should be expertly and rigorously assessed in their own merits. I agree with the additional track locations shown through the preserve area in general location, subject to final survey assessment, and I consider that they could be constructed using appropriate methods to ensure minimal adverse effects prior to the home sites being developed. I also consider that the amenity offered by them to the residents and wider community will offset the minor loss of visual amenity by developing an appropriate number of additional preserve home sites.
One, the use of the term appropriate, having appropriate regard for the information values. Can you expand on what you think of as appropriate?
Where is that?
Sorry, that was 5.1.1. You said in the wording of the zoning text, which includes the phrase.
Our appropriate regard would be something that would be assessed by the experts at that time. It's considered. It means that it's considered. That would probably be argued by the time.
Wouldn't it? That was a big suggestion for the regard.
Just the next one.
Well, just a clarification, what's it your understanding that the 95% figure we talked about earlier, so that apply to what we know as the Jacks Point land, or also include the Hanley Downs land as well?
Hanley Downs, Jacks Point, and so they can develop 5% of Hanley Downs, 5% of Jacks Point, and 2.5% of Hanley Downs. That's what they want to be.
backtracking.
I think that's right.
Now, in terms of the height limit on the land that's identified as current OGP, this ECAP OSCR, it's 4 metres, there's no site coverage limitation, but am I to take it that you feel that you're entitled to have some comfort in that 4 metre height for no other reason that nobody's really likely to put up a huge building which is only 4 metres high?
Yes, and it's quite hard to find a 4 metre high building.
Right. Yeah. So by indirectly, it does provide a degree of
Plus, the Clangburn and Resource Study always said that development should be clustered in that area. So, I wouldn't imagine it would be against that study if the whole thing was filled with
municipalities. Okay. I mentioned the comments in your paragraph 4.5 here, in terms of the definition of what's meant by different kinds of recreation. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that Mr. Wells has talked about commercial recreation. Now, I have got the rules in front of me at the moment, but he's saying basically the opposition plan allows what's currently the same thing you're talking about for outdoor recreation and open space. Now, I take it your criticism of that is that it's been outdoor recreation activities and open space has been taken as including commercial recreation. That's the point you're trying to make, isn't it?
In his evidence, he says that we should accept a certain number of commercial recreation baseline for that land.
And I'm contesting that. Okay, right, that's what I thought you meant. Now, in terms of the height of paragraph 5.3, again, I don't have it in front of me, but did you. So the VDP allows farm buildings of 10 metres in height as the current.
So that's what it's No, the
status
quo is still 4 metres
high. Oh, sorry, 4 metres high, and what you're seeking that that be retained in terms of farm buildings.
Yeah.
But that's, very well presented, thank you.
Just to conclude that issue of farm buildings, your experience of being there and seeing the farming that occurs on these open space areas, what sort of demand for buildings is likely to arise?
I honestly don't know. It depends on how the land is farmed. You know, and feel free to correct me anybody, but currently the land is leased to a farmer who farms a lot of the area around it and he keeps his implements occupied. Currently the land is, it was just pasture,
so it's just grazed.
Right, and that's a matter of debate that Richard will talk about later. The ongoing maintenance of that land is an item that keeps cropping up, so that's
just a following off of that, where I take it one concern you might have on that is that if a 10 metre height limit became accepted in the rural area, that on the basis of a permitted baseline, someone comes along later on and wants some type of commercial accommodation, something like that,
exactly.
And so all the effects are no different from our 10 metre height limit.
Yeah. And my worry with that is that, and you guys, the council isn't party to it, but we have private covenants, which we can be involved in the district plan process, but we can't be involved in plan changes. And so I think that we need to keep that baseline low, otherwise you can just go through and without our consideration.
So just a comment you just made there, is the agreement that you signed up to says you can't be involved and restricted to resource consents or plan changes, it doesn't apply to plan reviews.
It doesn't apply to plan reviews.
Thank you.
Richard, again, I keep volunteering Richard, but he knows about
the team
about that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm here deliberately, of course, shows that it's fair for the rest of us and staff to know.
We can ask him these questions and start to answer them. All of these things Mr. Brennan will be able to answer for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. and Mrs. Thomason. Boundary of the Dalgleish Farm, and also we have Millbrook on our northern and eastern boundaries as well. Thanks for the opportunity to participate in making our submission to you. I'm here this morning to communicate that we're working in good faith with Millbrook, and while we do not today withdraw our opposition to the rezoning of Dalgleish Farm, we believe our differences can be resolved and that when all of our concerns are settled, and we are mutually signed off on an agreement that we will formally withdraw our submission in opposition to the rezoning. And that portion of our submission relating to the rezoning of our property remains. That's it. Thank you very much.
Yes.
No, we've been in
Close
communication with them and
very
positive response.
We're here today for the Jardine Family Trust for Remarkable Station Limited for Scope Resources.
Oh, and also for Scope Resources.
Yeah, that's it.
I'm just crossing them out because I've got to know the wrong one.
Sir, what I can say is since the time of making the submissions on behalf of the Jardine Family Trust, they had Remarkable Station Reserve. Part of the Homestead Bay activity area of the Jack's Point Zone, which Jardine's own, has been sold.
Right.
So there's a successor in respect to the submission, sir. The part that's been sold is the activity areas in Homestead Bay, which include the village area.
So it's 318.
Yes. The open space residential area. And the open space horticultural area.
Right.
And I keep appear on behalf of the Homestead Bay Trustees Limited, which is the successor.
Right.
What's it called? Sorry. Homestead Bay Trustees Limited.
So does that mean you continue to own OSF and FBA?
Yes.
So FBA and OSF are still in touch with Jardines?
Yes, although part of that, sir, when I think about that, it just shot through my mind.
Jardines in fact have gifted two titles of land in that area to the Otago University recently, sir.
Right. But you're not representing me.
No, I'm not. Representing me, sir, no. Not yet. And I can say that Homestead Bay Trustees Limited have made a resource consent application in the open space residential area to create 12 what I would describe as rural residential allotments that's presently permitted in that zone. Open space residential. I'll ask Mr. Geddes to present his evidence to you, sir, but I can say that I have been familiar with this property since 1985 and the history behind the entire Jardine area, which was also included. They formerly owned Jack's Point area as well.
Could you Have you considered the recommendation, if it was partial recommendation from Ms. Jones because it's out of scope, but the suggestion of Ms. Jones that the village Homestead Bay be changed to a residential area?
I consider that in terms of scope and confirm that it's not as far as I thought it should.
But you didn't consider having the opinion with your client?
I did not. Mr. McDonald I kept commenting on that. Sir, my client, which would be Homestead Bay trustees, would prefer it to remain a village area and permitting the activities there. And in fact, sir, have substantially designed a hotel for that area. And they're still working through those sort of design considerations, so they want those opportunities for those activities beyond just the residential to remain.
Just one gentleman relating to the, I presume previously it was understood there would be integrated services, I presume stormwater reserve. So what's changed to make you want to turn it off?
Correct. Perhaps I can explain that in respect to options for water supply, for instance. At the moment, the water supply in the Jack's Point zone is a privately run water supply, run by the Coneberry Water Supply Company, which I think is owned by the Jack's Point Residents Association. It's a lake tank, in other words, it takes water directly out of the lake. It's an unsecured tank in that it's Class E, it's not protected. I understand that option was taken because at the time the developers of Jack's Point couldn't find or locate a secure water source. Since that time, my client's Homestead Bay trustees at Jardines have actually put two test bores down on their property in the vicinity of the village on their land and have found very good water there, a water aquifer. And their intention is to develop a secure Class A water supply. Their view is that such infrastructure should in the future be owned and not and maintained by the Queenstown Lakes District Council as a public system, not a private system. And that's why we would talk about the ability for an appropriate rather than integrated system. It would seem that their only option also is to have a separate effluent disposal option being of a similar nature to Jack's Point operating themselves, but on their own site. There's no ability for, I don't think, any capacity for them to connect into the existing Jack's Point supply. There may in the future be an option to bring the council reticulated sewage scheme, which is presently, as I understand, being extended to service in the Henry Downs, to connect that through to Homestead Bay, but that's it's early days in respect to looking at that and in fact whether there's legal routes to be able to do that through Jack's Point.
Yeah, what about that? Yeah, okay.
My question.
You got an answer to all the questions. And we'll see you back at the back of the office.
That's right. Thank you, sir.
Suggest this will contribute to the sustainable management of the state highway and use it for the community. Councillor Potts' proposed rule 41.5.6.3.
So there was mainly, would it be fair to say the primary concern NZTA has is that it does have a problem with the three locations. Essentially, its concern is that if Woolshed Road were to be used as an access point, it would be an approved design for it. That's the key thing, and that it would be an approved design and it would essentially be built to that design. That's the key thing. Just asking the devil's advocate question, what powers does NZTA have if the district plan would be to stop that road being used by as an intensified access point? So hypothetically, if the developer just sealed that 45 degree angle intersection and said, tough luck, I'm just going to drive up and go in and out of here, given it's legal road, do you have any other powers of your own that would prevent that outcome?
We couldn't create the access without our authorisation.
But as a legal road accessing to another state highway, so you do have powers.
But I couldn't do works within the road reserve without transport access permission. It's also a limited access road.
Right.
It is powers under the government and powers access.
Right.
Yes. So the transport agency can authorise accesses and determine what they're used for and how they access should be seen.
Okay, so that includes where a legal road comes off the same road. Okay. So using that as background, I suppose the next thing we're looking for is to have a trigger point that actually works. Like the one that's been talked about here, any increased uses is likely vague. So I suppose another option might be to say there shall be no subdivision within RHD-SH3 or RHD-SH2. Until such time that there is an approved design.
Yeah, what we were saying is that the intersection at the moment is not falling to the process of the projects.
Would be fall for the days of all the cars basically.
So any intensified use would require an upgrade intersection.
Yes.
So we would not support any further use on it until it's been upgraded.
Okay, thank you.
I did ask another presenter, and it's related to the way that NZTA seems to approach an intersection and just in time, where the incentive would be cancelled in terms of infrastructure to generally supply to the maximum of any development, sewage, stormwater, water, etc. I was just wondering the thinking behind trying to suggest doing intersections just in time rather than looking at development calls and saying, okay, we should, this is what should be anticipated from the house.
Not sure I totally understand, but in terms of historically, it was the marriage road to the subject site, the further development was deemed that certain access will be required at some time. It's going to be Woolshed Road. In the meantime, RCL has done the subdivision. And so, they're going to go to construct a new access. So, I'm not sure what the many museums suggested that we should be operating those accesses prior to development occurring.
It's just looking at trigger points of their business and how things come around. And actually, if you actually look at the development as a whole, circumventing the trigger point, you're just putting in looking at development as the targets and that's supposed to be putting in the intersection set up at the outset.
Yes. You also have concern funding those decision upgrades. So,
just in your paragraph 6, you said the modelling of the traffic effects means the matter of discretion of controlling the speed of development. Are you meaning all development or certain developments in certain locations within Jackson.
We haven't looked at that closely yet. Let's give you a bit of the development to this to sections that we'll be using as you grow next season.
So do you think it's much relevant to the closest
yes.
development?
Yes.
Right. That's a fine. Very fine. The other question I had is in your evidence, paragraph 19, you said that it's in relation to the second subdivision of RCL, but you said you are unaware of this recent proposal and discussions, any discussions between RCL and NCA. I just wondered if there was any advance on that.
No.
That when you talk about the modelling work, that would, the modelling work would not be for the purpose of deciding whether or not the axis is appropriate. It would be about the design of the axis.
Yes, and the capacity of the existing axis.
Yeah. Yes. That's my question.
I was still working on them on the plane, and I finished them earlier this morning, and while I can work from home here, I don't have a printer, so Scott Freeman's printing them for me, and they're right here at 5:30. So
we were doing it.
The idea was to get them to people so they had a chance to look at them. There is a full document reviewing, a track change review of planners, council planners. Own version of the because I thought that we collectively needed to do that for you. And I tried to get that on the website so other people can see it as well and if you have a chance. So if it's acceptable to you, the rest of the people I'm working with, because of you as a team, and includes Clive, who has considerable background in this area, as you know, we've got amongst some American board of us.
So that seems sensible to us to so that you can assemble everyone.
But it also gives the an opportunity to ask questions and get answers from the right people that can help.
That's fine. Okay, good. So,
I mean, if you want to start.